athlete.
Right. How many times have you changed cell phones in the last 10 years and why and how much different they are? Yeah. So it's even more so with human eggs.
I'm going to call to order the House Committee on Healthcare for February 21st. And see if we can get some work done. We'll have members wandering in and out, going over to the other side of the building to testify. We'll see if we can keep a quorum going most of the way. I'm going to open two public hearings and an informational hearing. I'm going to open public hearing on Senate Bill 1547A, on Senate Bill 1548A, and an informational on Senate Bill 1549. Vice Senator Lawrence Anderson can join us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm State Senator Lori Mona Sanderson. I represent East Multnomah County, Gresham, Troutdale, Village, and Fairview. I'm delighted to be before your committee, and I am. All of these bills passed unanimously out of the Senate, but I wanted to first, since no one else has signed up on the designating June 27th as Oregon Post-Traumatic Stress Injury Awareness Day, I just want you to know that this was brought forward by veterans. They're very concerned with the word disorder, and that's why they put in post-traumatic stress injury rather than disorder. I talked with the Psychiatric Association, and you know, the disorder is always going to be used when a diagnosis is a treatment code is going to be used. But veterans, we had really powerful testimony that veterans are concerned with the word disorder. Injury is okay, and if this means it will allow them to go in and get treated, let's use injury. And so it passed unanimously, and hopefully you'll be willing to do that also. Are there any questions?
I expect
okay, the next.
Move on the bill as soon as we have a moment.
Okay. Do you want to move it now?
No, go to the next
okay. The next bill I'll talk to you about is Senate Bill 1549. The first part of the bill is actually has three separate components to it. And the first part, the base bill, was that it would amend our law to maintain Medicaid enrollment throughout a hospitalization at the Oregon State Hospital. Right now, when they go into the state hospital, their Medicaid enrollment, they're disenrolled. And this causes real havoc because the average stay at the Oregon State Hospital, I forget exactly what it is, it's between 3 and 6 months. It's not very long. And if they have to then go through the entire enrollment process again, most of these people, it just takes too long. If they're being referred to a treatment center, like there's a treatment center in my district that I just visited a couple weeks ago, the transition into a behavioral health clinic or a treatment center is so much easier if they're just able to maintain that Medicaid enrollment. So the state hospital will bill Medicaid for the services as they're in, but fully expecting the claim to be denied for payment because, according to federal law, you know, there's no way that they are able to pay using Medicaid dollars when they're in a state hospital. So that's the first part of the bill, with no controversy to that. The second no controversy, the health savings account, approximately 50 to 100,000 Oregonians take advantage of the ability to deposit pre-tax money into HSAs to help pay for their medical services. So in order for insurance companies to offer the health plans associated with HSAs in the 2019 plan year and beyond, the state needs to adopt this technical amendment that will align state law with federal law. And so that's why we have this bill. Without this amendment, the HSAs in Oregon could be out of compliance with the IRS code that allows the money deposited in HSAs to be pre-taxed, and it could be subject for the patients to tax liability. So that's the second piece of it. And the third piece has to do with balance billing. That's when you go in to have a procedure done, and the anesthesiologist that's in network isn't there, and an out-of-network anesthesiologist has to come in, and then all of a sudden, after they get out of the hospital, they realize, oh, that doctor, the anesthesiologist, being billed a whole bunch of money, and they thought it was covered under their own plan. So as of March 1st, we're going to have a ban, so consumers will not have to pay for this surprise billing. But there's been a controversy between providers and carriers on how much should be charged for these out-of-network providers. And so we came to a consensus, believe it or not. And I didn't think we'd have it, so I wasn't even going to have that amendment in this bill. But the fact that there was motivation to get this done, it happened. And so that's what the third piece of it is. So are there any questions on that piece?
It's going to be another amendment that we're talking about, a technical amendment to deal with nurses and use of fluoroscopes, and I think that's going to...
You're going to put that in this one?
When you send over relating to health care.
Oh, no.
It opens up.
Okay.
So we'll
I know about that issue, too.
We'll be discussing that.
Okay. Questions?
And we'll have a formal public hearing on this bill on Friday. On Friday. Representative Buehler?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Greenlee. Could you just go into a little bit more detail about what the fix is to the balance billing problem? What's the reference, basically, for the billing?
First of all, remember, consumers aren't going to be...
Should we invite Rick up to talk about that?
Oh, yeah. Rick, Rick can be here.
Thank you.
I hear my cue. The gurus, my friends. I've really gotten to know these two in the past month.
Well, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, Rep. Buehler, to answer your question. My name is Rick Blackwell, policy manager for the Division of Financial Regulation. So what the agreement was that's represented in the A. Engrossed version of 1549 is basically that DCBS will engage in rulemaking to set a reimbursement rate that it's consistent with some really strong legislative direction, which is also in the bill. Basically, this will be 100% of allowed median net amounts paid to in-network providers by commercial payers. So basically, it takes the in-network rate that's already paid to folks, to providers that are within the provider's insurance network, and makes that the reimbursement rate for these situations where surprise billing would take effect. We'll use data to set the median will be derived from APAC data, so the All Payer All Claims database. So use the 2015 data set, which is the latest full year that's available. And so that data set will be used then to establish what the median looks like. There's also in the rulemaking a modifier for adjusting the median upwards for consumer price. For the consumer price index, it's pegged to consumer price index urban, so all items like food, fuel, that sort of thing. And so that's the rules that we'll need to set by the end of the year.
And there is a sunset date.
Oh, yeah, I can keep going. There's a few more things that I'll add a few more things to what the bill does. So Section 5 actually has us report to both committees, health and health committees in the House and the Senate by 2020 on certain matters that are related to the bill, the reimbursement rate, and the ban. So we'll be looking at complaints before and after the ban on March 1st. Be looking at the effects on provider networks as a result of the reimbursement rate. See if we can isolate that. Looking at impacts on premiums, we still want to make sure that whatever reimbursement rate doesn't actually have an adverse, noticeable impacts on premiums. And then ways to assure compliance with the base bill of 2339. And so There's actually in OLIS a dash A8 amendment, which will strike two lines of the reporting requirement, basically says that we'll not have to formally go to the medical provider boards in order to write the report. We can still consult with them, of course, on an informal basis to get some guidance on writing the report.
And the Senate is in agreement with that amendment that you have?
And as Senator Moss Anderson indicated, the bill does sunset by January 2nd, 2022. This will give us time to figure out if the reimbursement rate is working. If it is, we can remove the sunset in the next long session.
The whole bill doesn't sunset today.
No, just the reimbursement rate. Sorry, Chair Greenlee, that's right. Only the reimbursement rate sunsets. If there is some fixes that are necessary to the reimbursement rate, we can address them during that long session.
Give you what you
need. Yeah.
I was hoping, if you have other testimony on this bill, I was hoping that we can get this done today in lieu of doing it again on Friday. But you should be prepared to be here Friday in case it comes back up again.
Of course.
Senator, did you want to comment on 47?
Okay, real quickly. Let's see.
Is that the right thing I'm talking? Yeah, the concussion, though.
The Senate has been working, again, State Senator Lori Montes Anderson, the Senate has been working on expanding the list of qualified health professionals who can provide medical release of student athletes suspected of having a concussion. We've been working on this for, it went through Senator Roebland first, who tried, then Senator Steiner Hayward. And for some reason, after a work group during the interim, we were able to come up with a fairly good compromise. And basically, the state right now, this bill will expand the list of health professionals who provide medical release of student athletes suspected of having a concussion. And this does include licensed chiropractic physicians, naturopathic physicians, psychologists, physical therapists, occupational therapists, physician assistants, nurse practitioners, and athletic trainers. And we went extensively through their scope of practice in each one of these. And those who are interested are highly trained and actually better trained than just regular physicians who have not had the training in concussions. So basically, they will be eligible to return students to play if they have successfully completed an online concussion course that's being developed by OHSU with Dr. Chestnut being the lead. This is going to be a fee-driven program to the professionals who will be taking the training. And there will be others who will be here to testify if you have any further questions, or you can ask me.
Good. There are four people signed up to testify. We'll get to them in.
Okay.
Are there any other questions of this group? Thank you very much.
Thank you, committee, and we're almost done. We're getting there.
For all your work. Be tender to our bills.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm hearing the CCO bill and the Hope bill on Monday.
You can take care of both of those.
Okay. People are going to be wondering, you know, so I think we can take action. Mr. Analyst, if you would keep track of who's not here, we'll suspend rules and get them to vote. There is nobody else that wants to testify on Senate Bill 1548, is that right?
That's correct, Chair.
Let's close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 1548. Do you want to just talk to us about it? We've just heard something, but glad to hear your.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chairs, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 1548, brought to you by, as you heard, the Senate Committee on Healthcare. The bill establishes June as Oregon's Post-Traumatic Stress Injury Awareness Month. The measure also establishes June 27th as the Oregon Post-Traumatic Stress Injury Awareness Day. The bill urges the Oregon Health Authority, the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and the Oregon Military Department to continue working on educating victims of trauma about the causes, symptoms, and treatment of post-traumatic stress injury. Declares emergency, effective on passage. No revenue impact, there's no fiscal. The committee has paperwork, and the bill passed unanimously out of the Senate.
Do I have a motion?
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. It's good to be useful one day here. I moved Senate Bill.
You're always useful.
Well, my co-chair, Rob Nose, is not here, so I get you engaged. I move Senate Bill 1548 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hayden moves Senate Bill 1548 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Salinas?
Aye.
Representative
Vile? Excuse?
Representative Malmstrom?
Aye.
Representative Hanemer?
Excuse?
Representative Penny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Ewer?
Yes.
Representative Alonzo Leon?
Excuse?
Representative Bowles?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nose?
Excuse?
Vice Chair Hayden?
Yes.
Chair Greenlund?
Yes. Motion carries. Somebody like to volunteer to carry it?
Oh, I can do it. I'll do it.
Representative Malmstrom will carry it. Thank you. Close the work session on House Bill 1548 and continue with our open hearings. You have a panel of four.
I do. Yes, Mr. Chair. We have for Senate Bill 1547, we have Dr. Acebo and Dr. LaJoy.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, Dr. Vern Sabo, representing the Oregon Chiropractic Association, and I'm here in support of Senate Bill 1547, which passed, as Senator Mona Anderson indicated, 27-0 in the Senate. It's been a long journey. We've been working on this for nearly 3 years. I think I want to take the time just to primarily thank Senator Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, who conducted the first work group, Senator Arne Roblin, who convened the second work group, and then the four work group sessions we had during the interim. It's a lot of work that Senator Mona Anderson convened and worked very hard on, and I want to take the opportunity to thank those senators.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and committee. My name is Dr. Laura LaJoy. I'm a chiropractor in Wilsonville. I've been in practice for almost 25 years and have been working with this Senate bill for the last three since it got going in the first session. My particular interest in support of 1547 is that as a sideline doc who works with athletes from five-year-old soccer players to professional athletes and everything in between, is that when this was taken away from us to be allowed to do concussion return to play, it was like being a woman with the right to vote after 100 years having it being taken away. It was significant for those of us who had the experience and who were willing to take on the liability, which we know is huge. Some of the things that were significant in this bill in particular is that while we continue to do the work of concussion on a daily basis, not only with student athletes, a lot of people don't realize that as a chiropractor, we're doing motor vehicle injury, work comp, slip and fall, and many of these injuries also have concussion correspondence. So in support of 1547, this is important to the athletes, particularly that I work with, because the thing that did not change when the law changed was the number of pediatricians that were sending kids to us in order to do the rehab and the work to get them back to play and to clear them. The only thing that changed was, I don't know if you want to call it hassle, but the hassle of having to send the parents back to the pediatrician once the child was ready to be cleared. And we have a focus not only on return to play, but also return to learn. So that was significant.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions? Thank you very much. Another panel?
We do. We have Sam Johnson, Phil Donovan, and Lori Satinspiel.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick and fellow committee members for addressing the important issue of youth concussions. My name is Sam Johnson. I'm a faculty member in the College of Public Health and Human Sciences at Oregon State University and teach in the accredited graduate athletic training program. I also serve on the OSDA Sports Medicine Advisory Committee. Today I'm going to talk a little bit about athletic trainers and their role with youth concussions. We believe, as the Oregon Athletic Training Society, that if a list of qualified healthcare providers is to be expanded, athletic trainers deserve to be on the list. Entry-level athletic training education has multiple competencies related to concussion assessment, management, and return to participation. Additionally, the Oregon Athletic Training Practice Act already requires athletic trainers to have at least 2 hours of concussion or traumatic brain continuing education every 3 years. The current concussion law allows athletic trainers to return athletes who have been suspected of a concussion but are determined not to have a concussion, so on the sidelines, they're allowed to return them back to play. So implicitly, the law is acknowledging athletic trainers have the knowledge to diagnose concussions. This important exemption it remains in the current bill. Additionally, at least 30 other states require or allow athletic trainers to return concussed athletes to play. Athletic trainers working at the high schools typically provide care in the schools. This allows direct access to a healthcare professional at no cost to the athletes. Additionally, athletic trainers typically know the athletes before the concussion, so they're able to have some continuity of care. Athletic trainers are also encouraged to be part of the return to learn process for students. It's also important to note that this bill does not only apply to high school athletes, but also to athletes participating in youth sports, so such as non-club or non-school clubs teams. This is an area of growing concern in terms of sports safety, and this bill will allow qualified athletic trainers in these settings to provide care at the level of training. Athletic trainers have traditionally served as the last gatekeeper to protect student athletes from returning to play too soon. If the list is expanded, having consistent training amongst providers will help establish baseline standards. However, it will not have the unintended consequences of not having enough providers in the interim. Lastly, when complicated concussion cases arise and a patient needs more advanced care, the Oregon Athletic Training Practice Act clearly defines that athletic trainers are required to collaborate with physicians when it's beyond their scope or the injury is not responding to treatment. So from an educational standpoint and a practical standpoint, adding athletic trainers to the list will help strengthen the care of concussed athletes in the state. Thank you.
Do you support the bill?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. For the record, Phil Donovan here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians. Unfortunately, Dr. Sam Altman, who is hoping to be here today, was unable. His testimony is loaded up on OLIS, but I'm going to pinch hit for him. I'm going to also thank somebody. The work group that was convened during the interim was done by none other than Oliver Droppers. I got an email notice from him about 3 weeks after the close of legislative session, and I thought, oh, jeepers, I got to trek down to Wilsonville in August and start on this work group. But every month thereafter, Oliver brought us together, and I think he helped pick together a good bill for you all to consider. On behalf of the association, we support this bill. What Senate Bill 1547 does is it removes barriers to care for those patients who might see a naturopathic physician as their primary care provider, or for patients of naturopathic physicians who specialize in rehab and sports medicine. The third piece is we support the additional training requirement, and in particular, OHSU, Dr. Chestnut, who's been charged with developing this, our people say his trainings are good. And I will flag for you all that there is a report back in this legislation by OHSU on who's doing the training, how's the training look. So you all will have a look back at this legislation. So with that, I'll close. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chairs, members of the committee, Lori Satinspiel for the Oregon School Boards Association. I'm here in opposition. I had to come in opposition to this bill today. I think the biggest thing for me, I called OSAA, the Oregon Student Activities folks and said, do we need to expand healthcare providers? Are there districts? And I would ask each of you to call your district and say, do you know of any student that has not or has had a problem with getting back and returning to play? OSAA has not had one phone call that we need to increase the list. So my question is, why are we expanding the list? Okay. I was involved in the work group, and several members of OSBA have been involved as well. Some of our concerns: increasing the list of providers, adding some training. As Sam mentioned, the school district athletic trainers are sometimes and quite often our employees as the last provider or the last stop. We're going to be liable. We're going to get sued in all this if something goes wrong. And creating a more expanded list creates problems for schools. One of the biggest insurance carriers, AIG, has started exempting out of general liability coverage for TBIs. So we're concerned that there might be a trend coming in that. The certification that OHSU is working on isn't complete yet. And I will say that there's already exemptions for some of the docs who already have training programs, so they don't have to go through this training. So we're going to have some different types of trainings, which is concerning to us as well. And then lastly, we've talked about return to learn several times. We talked about it a little during the work group. I would like to see us continue to discuss how we receive those students back. I know there's been examples of a student has been returned to play, and the athletic trainer has caught that student, and they're not ready to come back and ready to go into the classroom as well. And there's some examples of that. And so I would like to see a more holistic approach to these kids. This is their future. And to expand the list, and no one says why. It concerns me. And I'd be happy to take questions.
Are there any questions in the panel?
Representative Vile. Thank you, and I apologize, Mr. Chair, for being late back to committee here. I'm curious as to how the current system works. Is there any sort of protocols that are in place that give us some certainty as to we're sure that this student should be returned?
So, Chair Greenlick, Representative Vile, I would like to actually pass that to Sam because he has been involved in that protocol and probably can eloquently explain it.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Vile. So the way the current law exists, if an athlete is suspected of a concussion, so that can be anyone can identify that individual as having a concussion. So it could be a referee, it could be a coach, it could be a parent, it could be anybody. It could say, I believe this student athlete has a concussion. They, based on the law, they have to be pulled from the competition. They are not allowed to go back in that competition that day. So they're out for that day. And then they need to be evaluated by a qualified medical professional. And right now, the current law has MDs, DOs, physician assistants, nurse practitioners, and psychologists. So they had to be evaluated by one of those individuals. And they cannot return to play until they've had a release from that individual, from that professional, and they are no longer exhibiting signs, symptoms, or behaviors of a concussion. Once that happens, the school can allow them to return back to play, or the coach is probably more appropriately, the coach can return them back to play. Typically, what best practice says is that return to play typically is through a graduated return to play program, and it's usually about a 5 to 6 day graduated program, as long as everything goes as planned. And that's based off of an international consensus statement that's updated about every 4 years. And so the training that is proposed in this bill will be based off of that training. Does that help answer the question?
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Is there a formal set of documentation that goes with this? As you described, it could be anybody. It could be the parent. It could be the trainer. It could be, I don't know, whoever notices the coach that a kid isn't acting right. Is there some form that's filled out that says, okay, we've noticed this. Now we've got these steps that have to take place, or does it all kind of happen informally?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Vial. So there is no form that is in statute that says it has to be used, or in rules that there has to be a certain form that is required when an athlete is suspected of a concussion. If it's happening at a school where there's an athletic trainer present, that will go into the student's health record, because there's a medical health record that the athletic trainer will be keeping. So there would be documentation of that. Schools that don't have athletic trainers, I can't speak to that. For the return to play process, the OSAA has a form that the medical provider can use. Our understanding is that most schools use that form. It is not actually required for them to use that form. We also believe, there is Max's Law, which covers high school sports or public school sports, and there's Jenna's Law that covers non-school sports. What we've heard is that some of those club sports have either developed forms or modeled forms based off of the OSAA form. So currently there is no required forms, but there is some districts have adopted or chose to use that form.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Boyle.
So in our school district, my kids all had to have a baseline concussion test at the beginning of the season, and then that's used to measure if there's an incident. Is that not statewide, or is that a school district policy? I'm probably asking you a question you may or may not know, but.
Chair Greenlick, Senator, or Representative Boyle.
Bowles.
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I apologize. It's not required. Most school districts are using IMPACT.
Mm-hmm.
OSA has funding for schools to use that as part of the return to play process. But my understanding it is that it is not required.
Follow up?
Go ahead.
So when you talk about the online concussion course at OHSU, that's for the provider to take to determine if they have the right set of tools to make the assessment. So when you said that, I thought, oh, this is something that's going to be instituted in the schools. Was that part of this conversation for the kids as far as the baseline? And you know what you're familiar with what I'm talking about?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bowles. We did not talk about any additional requirements for IMPACT testing.
Uh-huh.
And so IMPACT testing is the computerized testing, the neuropsychological testing that many students are required to take as part of district policy. That can be used as part of the return to play process, mm-hmm. and it often used. I know most every athlete trainer that I know uses that, but it's not necessarily required. I think one of the concerns, and part of the reason it probably didn't come up, and there may not be support for that, is that's going to require everyone to have a baseline, and that can be challenging to do in practicality, especially some of these schools that may not have an athletic trainer to be able to, do that. And then there's also the cost that's involved. And I know OSAA has provided, some of the cost or funding for IMPACT for some of the schools.
Mr. Chair, if I could, and follow up, though, I think.
Yes, go ahead.
To your question, Representative Bowles. The training is specific for the providers, and it's only for those providers that are being added to mm-hmm. the list. So it's not for the students.
Okay.
What is that, do you want?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Greenlick. I'm going to give a little shout out to my medical group, which I don't think I've ever done before, but we were one of the first provider groups in the entire country to provide IMPACT to all the kids in Bend Lapine schools. We paid for them to have, pre-involvement IMPACT testing. So I'm well aware of this issue, and I appreciate your great work on this too. You're nationally renowned and very humble with regards to this issue. Having said that, I have great concerns that we're extending this to athletic trainers. I've worked extensively with athletic trainers. We have athletic trainers on the sidelines. I think it's a big and dangerous overreach.
What's it expanded in the bill?
Expanding it that athletic trainers can return student athletes to play.
Representative Salinas?
Thank you. So does this bill expand to non-athletic injuries and concussions as well? So for instance, even though the student may be an athletic, an athlete in a sport, so for instance, I'm just thinking, my daughter at age 6 got a concussion, and it was a subdural hematoma that was almost missed by the attending physician in the ER, and we were almost released from that there down in California. We ended up spending 2 days at Oakland Children's Hospital in the ICU. But then once we returned to Oregon, she was released to play soccer, first grade soccer, but it was year-round soccer that she played. So would that this law apply to her as well?
I don't believe so. I believe this is just specific to return to play.
Okay.
There's
nothing in the bill, there's nothing that changes the process, is that right? Basically, it just changes who can be qualified to make the decision.
With additional training.
With additional training. Representative
Vile. Thank you. I apologize for jumping in again here, but
no problem.
Something that
today we have time.
Something that Representative Bueller asked about caused me to go back and look more carefully at the language of the bill, and I'm a little bit confused now. We've got a definition for qualified healthcare professional in line 11 of the on the first page of the bill. Means, and then it goes to a second sub B, a healthcare professional who meets the requirements. But I don't see a definition for a healthcare professional, and I'm wondering, is an athletic trainer, does an athletic trainer have a certification somewhere that makes them a quote unquote healthcare professional?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Vile. Later on in Section 3, it defines who a healthcare professional is. So 3.1. So it's healthcare professional includes a chiropractic physician, a naturopathic physician, a psychologist, a physical therapist, an occupational therapist, a physician assistant, a nurse practitioner, or an athletic trainer is licensed, certified, or registered under the laws of the state.
That goes to my question. Yeah. What does that mean, or an athletic trainer? I know that the other things in that list have licenses. Does an athletic trainer have a license?
Yeah, so in Oregon, we actually have registration. It's actually a licensure. If you read it, it's actually a licensure act, but it's registration. So it's through the Oregon Health Licensing Agency. And so that's who registers athletic trainers in this state. So you're required to have a registration. Nationally, there's the Board of Certification, which is the basically the standard everyone has. So actually, the Oregon registration requires you to have the Board of Certification.
If I could.
What I'm trying to figure out is this the docs that don't want somebody that's not a doc in their game, or what's going on here?
The only objection that I've heard up till now has been from the school boards that are afraid adding more people to this process will open them up for litigation. Which there's no chance of litigation if we haven't added these, I think. President Hayden, you had a comment.
Yeah, just a couple of quick comments here. Seems to be not the consensus on this bill that we saw in the Senate, but I just want to put on the record that the Oregon Medical Association remains opposed to this bill. I have some concerns with the example of a six-year-old bumping their head on the monkey bars, or whatever they call them these days. And I do have some concern with the athletic trainer and potential conflict of interest if that trainer is on the school grounds and part of the team to make sure that that star player gets back out there and gets that touch ball, that touchdown that Saturday night that's coming up, in 18 hours.
Yeah, maybe we should a little more discussion.
We're having, we're in public hearing right now.
No. Yeah, I'm going to tag along with what Representative Hayden said. To me, there is a potential conflict of interest also with the athletic trainers whose job is dependent on being hired by the coach of the teams. And there may be undue influence and pressure to return an athlete due to that lack of firewall that the other providers have. regards to this issue.
Can I respond to that, Chair Greenlick? So one of the things we've heard this before about the concern about athletic trainers' conflict of interest, and without a doubt there is there's pressures. I mean, there's pressures on all professionals, and to single out athletic trainers, I think, is potentially a little misguided. I mean, I think at some level, yeah, they are right there, and they are hired by the schools in some cases, not in all cases. Sometimes it's hired by a hospital or a hospital, you know, foundation in the case in the Ben LaPine area. But one of the things I think is really important to note is the current law allows athletic trainers to make sideline diagnoses of concussions. And they're allowed to return athletes that they determine that are not concussed to play. And to me, that's where the greatest risk is. You know, once an athlete is diagnosed with a concussion, there's a graduated return play protocol that is best practice. If you're not following that, I mean, that's a 5 or 6 day process. It's pretty easy after the concussion to return them to play. There's about, you know, when you talk to the experts, about 80% of concussions clear without any complication. It's about the 20% that we worry about where there's extended, you know, symptoms. And those need to be referred to specialists. There's no doubt about it. But the risk is really on the sideline. And so when I think about the pressure and the conflict of interest, that's where the pressure is really going to be. I need so-and-so to go back into the game. I need them to win this game. And I guess I'm just not seeing that be the case. I actually talked to, it's in the current law. And we're just not hearing stories of that happening. You know, I actually was talking to an athlete trainer today, and he said, you know, 10 years ago, before the law was in place, I used to get a lot more pressure from coaches to say, can I get so-and-so back in the game? We really need him. He goes, now, he goes, the coaches are bringing him to me and saying, I don't think this athlete should go back in. I don't think, you know, I think I'm concerned about them. So I think because the way that, you know, Oregon was one of the first two states to have a concussion law, now all 50 states do. We still model it. A lot of states really model what we have here. But I think that concussion education that's required in the law for coaches has really gone a long ways. So without a question, I think there is concerns about conflict of interest. I think it should be, and it's probably not even conflict of interest. It's probably more pressure on the healthcare provider. I think that happens for all. I think all providers on the list. I think the other piece is by adding athletic trainers to the list, you're actually empowering them, and you are letting the people know that they have the training. And athletic trainers are healthcare providers. They are recognized by the American Medical Association as a healthcare profession. 70% of athletic trainers have a master's degree. By 2022, it will be required that all entry-level athletic trainers have a master's degree in athletic training.
To his point, Chair Greenlick, if I may.
Sure. Yeah.
The current law presumes that every medical doc, every nurse practitioner is capable of signing on the return to play form. The current law also presumes that no other medical professional is capable of signing off. And I think what we found in the work group discussion is that there are some medical docs, there are some naturopathic physicians, there are some athletic trainers that have the expertise to do sign the return to play form, and they're going to demonstrate that by doing this additional training. So I think in part that's why athletic trainers were included, and that was a lengthy conversation that we had with Dr. Chestnut in the work group.
Any other questions in the panel?
Yeah.
I'll wait to discussions. No, I'm good.
Representative Bowles?
Oh, I'm good, thanks.
I'm sorry?
I'm good. I'm okay. Thanks.
Anybody else?
Yeah.
Bueller.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I'm going to push back a little bit on the conflict of interest with athletic trainers, because certainly it's much different if you're employed actually by the team, by the school district, than a provider like me. I have no employment or risk of not having that kid go back to play. And I'm going to push back also with regards to the sideline things. I mean, there's no one else who's going to be able to do that. It's by default that the athletic trainer has to do it, because many times there's not other providers around. Mm-hmm. So when it's outside of that incident of the day, there's lots of other people who can do it. So I don't think they're really valid.
Chair Green, like Representative Bueller, I think one of the things that we do see, and one of the concerns that's been brought up, is this idea of doctor shopping. You know, are athletes going to go out and try to find and it probably happens right now. That kind of goes back to my idea that athlete trainer is that last gatekeeper, you know, that they are that last line of defense. And we heard it in previous testimonies about, other physicians talking about how, you know, they know that the athlete trainer is that last line of defense. And so, I agree. I mean, I think there is work to be done to educate administrators, make sure there's policies in place that the athletic trainer has to do it. You know, it very well may be the case that school districts don't allow the athletic trainer to even return to athletes to play because they don't want to take the risk. I mean, I think that's one thing we've heard from some of the school districts. But to not allow athletic trainers to be on the list when they have the qualifications, I think isn't correct.
Can I just follow up on that?
So,
and the qualifications of an athletic trainer compared to all the other professionals on the list is much less. I mean, you can become an athletic trainer with an associate's degree.
Chair Green, like, that is incorrect.
Athletic trainers with a bachelor's degree, and there's no one else on that.
Well, athletic trainers are required to have a degree in athletic training from an accredited school of
a university.
Not
an advanced degree.
So starting in 2022, it will be at the graduate level. So right now at Oregon State, we have a graduate program in athletic training. So any athletic trainer that comes through. In the past, it was an undergraduate program. It's always been an undergraduate program.
Yeah, and just to clarify, there's no other provider on the list in this bill that doesn't have a advanced degree.
Occupational therapists, I don't think, beyond, it'd be the same as, you know, with the master's
degree.
Yeah, PT just recently went up to a DPT.
Had master's.
They'll have master's.
So athletic trainer, just to be clear, doesn't have an advanced graduate degree, and everyone else on the list does.
That is correct. Currently, within a few years, everyone will. Now, 70% of athletic trainers, or at least in basic statistics we've seen, 70% of athletic trainers do have a master's degree currently.
All right, I'm back in for real.
Go for it.
I'm trying to weigh whether this is a discussion or if this is a question, but since we're having this interaction, I know a little bit about this from personally. I have a 6-foot left-handed volleyball player in high school. She's a third-year college student now, but she had two concussions, and quite honestly, it was the athletic trainer that she had a relationship with for 4 years that recognized that she was not okay. And we went through, and that's why I was surprised, because it was the actual impact testing that she got released to go back to play, but she couldn't pass her impact testing. And then it turned out that she had something that happened to her eyes. So then, I mean, it was she was committed to playing at Western Oregon, and she's like, I've had two concussions in a year, and I'm going to go run track. That was kind of her decision, and that's what she ended up doing, and it was a good decision for her. So I'm very concerned. There's, just to make a statement, there's so much pressure on some of our athletes she's a great athlete, and to get back into the game by their coaches, by the community, by some
parents.
I'm not decided where I am totally on this bill, because I recognize the 3-year conversation that's gone on that I haven't been a part of. But separately, it's very serious business when we're talking about people's heads. And my son played football. His best friend got hit in the game, and they were in another part of the state, and no one noticed it. And Michael was the one, because he walked through it with his sister. He went to the coach. He went to whoever. He's not okay. And he wasn't okay. I mean, he was almost like weaving. So I'm not a medical professional, and I'm not sure about opening this up to, I think the shopping for docs is in communities. You could talk about the athletic trainer on the sidelines being employed by the school district, but you also, I mean, everyone knows who the athletes are. Everyone knows their parents. I mean, we want our team to go to state. We want to keep them in the game. I walked through it, and it's tough. And it's disappointing, because people's dreams are getting shattered. But this is their brain, and these are kids. So I want to err on the side that we're protecting our kids, and not. That's where I land on this. So,
Mr. Chair, should I invite a response?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, if I might, just to your point, this is a big deal, and you know, prior to 2015, these providers were signing return to play forms, and Senate Bill 521 passed, and the providers that were allowed was changed, and that's when the legislation in 2017 right. came forward, and that was just a provider bill. But, you know, the discussion that took place in the Senate hearing was, okay, we're contemplating these providers, mm-hmm. but, you know, one of the good senators from Springfield leaned back and said, who's to say that MD that was trained in 1970-something, mm-hmm. or who's to say a nurse practitioner was trained, you know, 15 years ago, is up to snuff on the latest mm-hmm. in this evolving mm-hmm. scientific world sure. of concussions.
Right.
And so that's why the legislation right. changed from being about just provider types to provider types and right. an additional training so that here in Oregon, everybody's sure. knowledgeable of the latest.
Right. Follow up on that?
Sure.
So if the, you know, the MD or the, you know, the chiropractor, whoever, returns a student to play, and that person may or may not be ready to play, who's going to be responsible at that point?
Well, the provider would be responsible for the liability.
You know, but the school I think there's
If any medical provider that signs off on the return to play is going to be liable.
Okay. That's yeah, Lori?
Chair Greenlake, Representative Bowles. That's where I get nervous, because that means we're the last line of defense, and if that student goes back in because we have this note and there's a second concussion and there's further impact, mm-hmm. the district is still going to be liable.
Representative Salinas.
Thank you. Do we have examples from other states that have expanded the list of providers for return to play concussions?
Chair, like Representative Salinas, I can only speak to athletic trainers. We know at least 30 other states allow athletic trainers to return athletes to play. Washington, Alaska, I'm looking at our surrounding states, Nevada, Idaho, I have the list, but at least 30 allow athletic trainers. I can't speak to any of the other professions.
Chair Greenlake, Representative Salinas. I actually just had my office tell me today that states are more likely now, their trend is to start tightening down who is doing concussion, and they're much more sensitive and in the definition of who's getting to do this. And I can get more information, but that's about as much as I had as I ran out the door. Thank you.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Green. Like, does anybody on the panel want to address malpractice liability, comparison of an athletic trainer requirements versus a physician? Let's say an athletic trainer is a independent contractor for the school. What kind of malpractice liability does that provider, in this case, what requirements of malpractice liability do they have?
I think the answer is no. Nobody wants to discuss that.
No, I'll give it a shot. Chair Greenlee, Vice Chair Hayden. There are no requirements for physicians or athletic trainers or any healthcare professional to have a certain level of liability coverage. We do know that most practitioners, you know, if they're employed, are going to have through their employer. So, whoever might be the independent contractor who you're speaking to specifically, it's up to that provider to make sure that they are, you know, have malpractice insurance. It is best practice for all athletic trainers to have malpractice insurance, whether they are working as an independent contractor or not. Same thing with physicians. We actually see this sometimes where a physician will go out and say, I'm going to cover this event separate of my employer, and they may or may not be covered. It actually came up in the work group this summer when we were talking about that. So, you know, one thing we encourage, you know, as a national organization of athletic trainers, is that all athletic trainers have liability insurance. And there's actually a large push from a national organization to, you know, make sure you have adequate. You know, there's a whole toolkit that just has been released to try to ensure that. But I can't speak directly to how many, if any, of these practitioners have are covered as an independent contractor.
Chair Greenlee, Representative Hayden, in a previous version of this bill, there was a liability of $1 million in the bill that was required, and that was pulled out.
Yeah, it was pulled out because there was a belief that it would set a precedent, a requirement of insurance that wasn't found anywhere else in statute.
Thank you very much. You guys got to... have a chance to talk about it.
Could I ask one more question, Mr.
Sure,
Chairman?
Sure, go ahead.
I'm sorry.
We are, incidentally, I'm going to carry this bill over to Friday.
Okay.
We'll have discussion on Friday.
I'm having a little bit of trouble wrapping my head around the concern about the school being the last place that pays out when we get sued. Mm-hmm. Aren't we probably better off as a school to be able to say we only allowed folks that have this certification tell us when it's time to return a student? It seems to me that that's going to be better than what we have now, which is you hired a physician, or you allowed a physician who really didn't know anything about heads to return this student, and that's on you, school, because you didn't check out who knows heads and who doesn't.
Chair Greenlink, Representative Vile, perfect question, and I thank you for that question, because part of the population that won't have to take the training are folks that are already doing this. As a school district, I'm concerned about knowing if they've taken the certification and us provide, you know, the return to play comes back with this, yes, we've taken the certification, however this form is designed. Do we need, as a school district, to be checking, did this person actually take the certification? That's kind of my ongoing concern about this process as we move forward.
I really have to weigh in on this too. Representative Vile, it's triggered me too. There's nothing in this that forces a school district to hire anybody who's not qualified. Why? I don't understand why creating a class of people who get special training to allow you to select from in any way increases your liability. If you're making stupid decisions on who you allow to make this, the school district should be liable. I don't understand how this expands any problem for you.
Okay.
Can you help me with that?
Before you go, could I excuse myself? I have a chairman to get
to. I'm sorry, yes, go ahead. We will close the public hearing.
No, sir, I don't mean to shut
down.
No,
it's fine. We'll be back on Friday and we can talk about it some more. Anybody wants to talk about it.
Sorry.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 1547. Close the public hearing, close the informational hearing on Senate Bill 1549A. And do we have enough people to, some folks back that missed the vote?
Representative Vile for 1548.
Can I have a motion to suspend the rules?
Chair Greenlick, I request unanimous consent that the rules be suspended to allow Vile to record, to be recorded as voting on motion. What
House Bill 1548.
1548. This will not change the outcome of the vote.
Yes.
We have a motion to suspend the rules to allow Representative Vile to vote on Senate Bill 1548. Is there any objection? Hearing none. Representative Vile, would you like to vote on 1548?
I would. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'll vote yes on that bill.
Representative Vile votes yes. We'll be back at 8 o'clock on Friday morning. I hope this is the last Friday morning we need to be back at 8 o'clock.
Do we have to be 8? Do we have a big
agenda? Does it have to be
8? I think we're fine. Can we make it 8:30?
Sure.
Let's see
that. Oh, I love that. Make it 8:30 Friday morning.
8:30.
That should be plenty of time. Friday will be the last day we can work on Senate bills. So.
It will?
No. Monday.
On Monday, that's right. Okay. We have time. We are adjourned.